It's been almost a year since Lamont McIntyre was found innocent of two counts of murder in a Kansas court of law. But he was only found innocent after spending more than half of his life behind bars, 23 years to be exact. He'd gone into prison at 17-year-old, and he was about to leave a free man at 41. There are a lot of things Lamont McIntyre is just now getting to do for the first time, and voting is one of them. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're picking up our series on first-time voters with a closer look at the experiences of people who were incarcerated when they turned 18. Lamont's story kicks off that discussion. Lamont McIntyre, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
There must have been so many things you were eager to do when you were set free after 23 years behind bars. Can you talk to me about where voting fit in?
Voting fit in is another form of freedom for me. For a long time, my rights was taken away from me. So since the Voting Rights Act and it's from 1965, I've had the opportunity to vote, or at least the right to vote, but I never had an opportunity to express that right. I didn't think about it a lot when I was younger because I didn't know how much voting would affect my life or my community the way it does now.
Saying like in the earlier part of your sentence, that wasn't something you thought about as much?
Yeah, when I was younger, I didn't think that voting was that important because I didn't think that me voting would affect anything personally about my life. So I didn't take a lot of thought towards voting. So when I got older and I understand now how much voting impacts my life and my community, that now I take it very seriously. So when I had the opportunity to sign up to vote, yeah, I took that opportunity.
Can you take me through that journey a little bit of sort of the milestones where you stepped back and thought, voting really matters?
Absolutely. For instance, health care, something I'm struggling with now. People may not understand how voting will connect to health care, how voting may not will connect to taxes, the way I live, the economy I'm a part of. So when I got out and I started my life over, I needed a license, I needed my ID, I needed health insurance, I needed all these different things. And I didn't understand at the time that voting plays a big part in all of those things that I feel that's important to me.
Were there times when you were in prison that you thought about what was going on politically and wanted to have a voice in it?
Absolutely. I saw a lot of things I didn't like. I just didn't know I had the power to do anything about it. Now I understand that voting is a tool that can be used to help change the things I don't like about the society I'm a part of. So, yeah, I thought about that a lot.
Can you tell me about a time when you thought about it?
Absolutely. For instance, when certain officials are elected in office, we may not think that they would have such an influence on a person's life and well-being. And I was a part of a system that had a lot to do with my incarceration, right? So I now understand the importance of voting certain officials in office to make sure that the justice system is ran properly, or people are held accountable for the things they do. Police and all these certain things has a lot to do with voting. So, yeah, I thought about it.
Does the criminal justice system and elected officials' positions on the system, on how it works, does that matter to you? I mean, obviously it matters to you. Is that something that you feel like you're able to research with different candidates and really vet them for?
Absolutely, because the term voting just means expression of opinion and preference. So if some people have a certain preference of how people deal with law or how people stand on law is, so is policing, for instance, is very, very important that we, as the people, vote certain people in position to make sure that the law is distributed evenly, that it's a fairness in it. So at first, I didn't think that played a part. My vote would count towards that kind of thing. But it's really very, very important that we understand the power of our our voice, the power of our right to choose to vote. So, yeah.
You actually voted for the first time in the recent primaries, right? But before we talk about the vote itself, I want to talk about getting registered to vote. What was that like?
That was just another process in my life, another step of evolution for me trying to start my life over. So I looked at another milestone, just another thing I always thought about, wanted to do. And now that I have that right, you know, I feel free. I feel liberated.
Take me back to the moment where you got your voter registration.
I was excited, you know, because like I say, that's another form of freedom for me. So that was just like me getting another phase of my life liberated. I'm being freed in another way. So I was just excited just to be in that place like everyone else, you know, to express my opinion and my preference.
Was it at all complicated figuring out how and where you would get your voter registration, or did that seem pretty straightforward?
No, I had a support system that's amazing. Like my lawyers and my legal team, you know, from the moment I walked out, I had Lindsay was one of my co-counsels, and she helped me through every step of my process. So it was pretty easy for me because I had a lot of people who's been here voting for years and they serious about voting. So they took me through the process and it was simple.
Tell me about casting your first ballot.
It was good. I did it with my wife. So it was just me and her when I did. I was excited. I wanted to take pictures, but I didn't want to be too cheesy with it, right? So I was excited, but I don't want to bring so many people into it. Like, to me, that was just a moment I wanted to have for myself. So
yeah.
I did. I took it in, and I did it slow. That was the slowest process of my life.
What were you taking your time for? Just to, like, treasure it? Or were you really taking that last moment to think through every vote?
I was thinking, I mean, leading up to that, I thought about it so much. But then when the moment came, it's like, this is one of those moments where I'm a saver. I don't want it to go so fast. I want it to be a memory. And it's a memory now. It's something that I'll always remember, something I always cherish. And now I want other people to have that same experience. I'm always going to think about that moment.
Do you think that people who haven't had an experience like yours, where their voting rights have been suspended in some way, that maybe those of us on the other side of it don't always appreciate this experience the way you do? I mean, people talking about how long they have to wait in line, all that kind of stuff. It sounds like a longer wait in line would have been just fine with you.
Absolutely. We do take that for granted. We take a lot of liberties for granted. A lot of things is given to us and handed to us. We take it for granted. Like, everybody complained about the school systems. They complained about grocery stores in the neighborhood. They complained about policing, but they don't understand that their vote matter. And that's one thing they take for granted, that you have the opportunity to change the things you don't like.
Are you excited for November?
Yes, I am.
What are you doing to get ready?
Studying. I'm studying a lot. I'm reading a lot. I'm doing the same. I'm researching.
Talk to me about what that process is like, because right now, just no matter who you are, that with how polarized the political landscape at least feels, just finding the information you want and making sure that knowing the sources that you're getting it from, that's an overwhelming process, even if you've been doing it for your whole, like, adulthood. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Are you finding that is an overwhelming piece of it, or no?
I just try to, really, my process is looking around. I'm paying attention to my community. I'm paying attention to what's needed and what could be beneficial for me and my community. So wherever I can go, or whoever I can study up on or look at to see what's going to suit and benefit the community the best is where I'm going. That's my process. I don't really have a complicated process other than that.
Can you give me an example of something you think would benefit you and your community?
Absolutely. For instance, they had a Whole Foods store opening up, a grocery store opening up in Wyandotte County. Never had one. Quality of food is better there. So I think that's something that's needed in that community. So I'm supportive of that. I mean, the idea of having a grocery store where Whole Foods and natural foods and good foods in that part of the community is important. So
that's I'm on board.
The Merck, yeah.
What about your first presidential election? That's obviously a couple of years off, but are you thinking about that already?
Absolutely. I thought about that from, absolutely. I'm excited. I think I will go to Washington. I don't think I'll be here. I think I'll be going to Washington to do all that.
Like an absentee ballot?
I will be there. I want to be on scene. I don't want to vote where I'm from. I want to go to Washington and vote if I could.
What would that mean to you?
That would mean change. That would mean the beginning of something great, not only for me, but for everybody else that may not even have the opportunity to vote. I feel like I'm doing this just not for me, but people who care about their community and the things that are going on in their community but don't have the option or the voice to vote. So I feel like I'm carrying all that.
Can you tell me more about the people who don't have the option or voice to vote?
That's, like I say, voting is a form of expression of opinion and preference, right? But certain things will limit people from doing that. Doesn't mean that they don't care about certain things. It doesn't mean that they're not passionate about the things that go on in the community. They just don't have the right to vote.
Are you talking about people who have been incarcerated or are incarcerated, or are you talking about more than that?
I'm talking about people who's been incarcerated. This is that in certain places, I just found out that in Missouri, after a certain amount of time, that you can regain your rights to vote. But in Kansas, I'm not sure about that. So it's people who would love to be a part of that process, but they can't. Now, that's an issue because those votes are needed. Young people now don't vote. That's a problem. Young people from 18 to 29, that's a gap. People don't even vote. They don't even use that right. They don't even use that resource. So I think that every time I step out to do something like that, I want people to know that I'm going to vote. Even if you can't, I'm always be a voice and a tool for people who can't do it.
Are these things that you've talked about with other people who either are incarcerated or have been incarcerated?
Absolutely. We had this dialogue a lot, you know, because we understand now as older people and older mature people, we understand the power of vote. The vote. I used to watch people with these like the vote or die. These people had these different platforms to vote and they was pushing this. You need to vote. You need to vote. I didn't understand at the time how much voting affects everything you do, all the way down to your taxes and the way you live, where you live.
Lamont McIntyre, hang out with me through this break, okay?
Absolutely.
In just a minute, we will put Lamont's experiences in local and national context. This is KCUR's Central Standard with a series on first-time voters in 2018. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've just heard the story of Lamont McIntyre, who served 23 years for a crime he didn't commit. He started serving time as a 17-year-old back in 1994, which means he didn't get to vote when he turned 18. In fact, he didn't get to vote until he was in his 40s. He cast his first ballot in the August primaries, and he's really excited for November. Lamont McIntyre, welcome back.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk now with Stephen Barbie for just a minute. He's joining us by phone. He works with people getting released from prison on integrating back into society. Voting is one of the things he talks to folks about, and he has some personal experience. He also used to be incarcerated. He regained his freedom and his voting rights in 2014. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
When you got your freedom, was the opportunity to vote something that mattered to you the way it mattered to Lamont?
Well, most assuredly. The timeline, I'm sorry, was actually 2012.
Oh, sorry.
January on my release, but the 2014 was when I was released from my probation and parole. And so that's where the 2014. So at that time was when I actually regained my voting rights after doing a federal prison sentence across the country here.
So there was a 2-year gap between your release and regaining voting rights.
Yes, it was. It was a process. Like Lamont, there's that process of reentry and adaptability. How to adapt back into society, because so much has changed since my incarceration, and then of course with computers and technology, how do I catch up and how do I get back in the game? And so, yes, that was a barrier and a personal and emotional experience for me.
Tell me a little bit more about that catching up piece of it, and how that played into casting your first ballot.
Well, it was sometimes it was moment by moment. I meant coming out of incarceration environment. There are so many needs that was lacking: birth certificate, state ID, Social Security card. And so those documentations are so important to the process of reentry that when I was released January 18 of 2012, I did not have any of those IDs. I did not have any of those identification purposes. And so my first endeavor, I'll never forget, was to go get my birth certificate here in Kansas City, Missouri, and me not being from Kansas City, not knowing where 2400 Truth was, that was just an emotional experience for me to go there and to obtain my birth certificate. And then, the next step was to obtain my Social Security card, and then the next step was my ID. And so the process of getting to the voting booth was a process by me getting the correct identification that I needed.
Did you have the kind of support Lamont is talking about having had, just people who were there ready to help him every step of the way?
If my family, my dad's still living there in Lawrence, Kansas. Pastor Leo Barbie's 80 years old. I had my dad, my sister, Victoria, she lives here in Kansas City. My younger brother at the time, he lived here in Kansas City. So I had the family support, and then I began to build a very safety net. I met people along the way, like Ricky Peters, a gentleman I didn't know, but now he's a good friend and a mentor still to this day. And he helped me with the process of regaining employment, regaining really a new identity after my release from incarceration.
When you now work with other people who have experienced the same thing, what sometimes gets in the way of voting for people who have spent previous election cycles behind bars?
Really, it's believing, if I could use this in a general, believing the lie. I'm a felon. I can't vote. I believe that information is what we as a society, those in my position, needs to educate and to empower individuals that, yes, you do have a setback because of the choices you make. But, just like in the last big election, in the state of Kansas, there was close to 500,000 felons who didn't vote, who could have voted. And the reason why they didn't vote was because they had believed, well, I'm a felon and I can't vote. But there are certain steps that you can make to regain your voting rights. And, of course, it's case by case, state by state. But if you have the right information, eventually you will and you can walk back into that voting booth.
Do people have to pursue that differently in Kansas versus Missouri? Because, yeah, regulations around all of this do vary from state to state.
Yes, it does. And for me, I'm very fortunate. After I was supposed to get released from probation parole in June of 2017, but because of me being a law-abiding citizen and being very focused, I was very fortunate, very blessed to only have to serve 26 months. And so March 3rd of 2014, the same judge that rendered my sentence was the same judge that closed my case. And at that moment, it was when I was able to vote again. Now, did I vote? No, there was a process. I had to submit a voting registration. And I did that there at the DMV out there in Olathe. I will never forget the day when I had my driver's license off suspension restored. And the lady says, are you registered to vote? And I told her no. And I told her the reason why. And she said, no. She said, you can. And so I filled out the documentation. Of course, I was so proud to have my driver's license there. And so I had the right documentation, filled out the card. And really, there was a moment of waiting.
But you know what? Like, that is so incredible to me that had you not shared why you weren't registered to vote, And had she then not known that that you were missing some information, and in fact you could, like, the chance encounter with this woman at the DMV is possibly why you voted.
Most definitely. You know, I don't remember her name. I don't remember her face. But if I could reconnect with that lady today, I would give her a hug, because she was a life changer. She was a bridge builder in my life. And, you know, for her to be very patiently, instead of seeing me as a felon or seeing me as a felon or seeing me as an ex-offender, she saw me as an individual that had a desire to make change. And she helped me to make change. And, you know, and I'll never forget the day when that voting card came in the mail, and I literally held it in my hands, and I was in a state of awe-ness because my voting rights have been restored.
You know, hang on with me a second, because Lamont McIntyre, we've heard from Stephen Barbee about this idea of what he calls believing the lie, which he puts as, I'm a felon, I can't vote. Is this something that resonates with you?
Absolutely. I know it to be true. Where I'm from, Kansas, I mean, I never heard of someone being a felon in Kansas and then getting their rights restored to vote. I don't think that happens in Kansas. It's a Missouri thing. It's a state by state, like he said. So it's a reality that is true from where I am and the people I know.
Stephen Barbee, what do you say about this?
Well, it goes back to, like I said, it's not a blanket. It's a case by case. You know, I don't know if you heard about the lady in Texas that she was in a halfway house. She had been reporting, and even her probation officer, parole officer, did not tell her that she couldn't vote until she got off paper. Well, she voted while she was on paper, and now she's ready to go back to federal prison. Why? Because she got the wrong information. And so I believe that we just have to find out, sit down and talk with individuals and find out what their situation and circumstances, because it's usually after. Some, it may be immediately. You know, I was very fortunate that as soon as I was off court services, I obtained. Certain times, there's a 3-year waiting period. Certain times, a 5-year waiting period. Certain times, a 7-year waiting period. But if we get the right information to the individuals that have a desire to regain their voting rights, I think it will literally change, you know, the next several elections if those that can't vote today will vote.
Well, Stephen Barbee, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And, you know, Lamont, you know, I haven't met you, but I've been following you. And, you know, your message and your ministry and your outcome, I tell you, you're inspiration to millions of people, not only in the state of Kansas, Lamont, but across this great country. And so I want to say congratulations, stay focused, and like I said, greater opportunities are coming your way, Lamont. And I want to thank KCUR for having me on this morning.
Well, thank you. And yeah, that's really a moving, that, do you hear that from people a lot?
Yeah, I do.
That must be really moving.
It is. It's touching.
I want to bring in another guest now for some national perspective and maybe to respond to some of what we just heard about the differences between states on this issue. Let's turn to Eli Hager. He writes for the Marshall Project. That's a news organization that focuses specifically on the U.S. criminal justice system. Hi, Eli.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Can you, first of all, reflect a little bit on what we've just heard?
Sure. I think that what Stephen said about getting information to formerly incarcerated potential voters being the key to all of this is really important. A lot of states recently have changed their laws when it comes to who can and can't vote and whether a felony conviction on your record should be disqualifying. But not all of those states have followed up those new laws with efforts to educate these potential voters of their new rights. So, for example, in Alabama, there was a law change last year that made a lot of felonies that used to disqualify you from being able to vote no longer disqualifying. But they didn't really educate people about that law. And so there's still a lot of formerly incarcerated people around the state of Alabama who just have no idea that they can vote.
What kind of numbers are we looking at? I mean, you've written a pretty in-depth article about this issue, about how more ex-prisoners can vote than do, the problem being that they don't know they can vote. Can you talk more about, just beyond a single state, how big is this voting bloc that could be voting and isn't?
Well, there are about 6 million people nationally who are disqualified from voting due to a felony criminal record. And so obviously that's a lot of people. One thing to note is that fully a quarter of those people, about 1.7 million people, are in Florida. So Florida is kind of a hotbed of this. Basically, there are so many voters there who are disqualified based on having a criminal record that it really truly could swing an election. And that's why it's really important that there's a constitutional amendment on the ballot in that state this fall that would make people with felony convictions, not including murder or rape, to vote again. And if that ballot initiative were to pass, it would totally change the nature of elections in Florida, which obviously is a big swing state and all of that.
So from your perspective, it sounds like what's at stake here in some cases really could be the outcome of an election. What else is at stake here?
I think I really what Lamont said about feeling like this was part of, getting his citizenship back, his freedom back, that really resonated with me. Because in talking with voters who have had their rights restored after being incarcerated, that was something that a lot of people said, that they got out of prison and that was kind of one step in feeling like a full American again. There was more steps to it, and one of the other big steps was getting their voting rights back. And when they got to go to that ballot box for the first time, they felt like a citizen. They felt like they were part of this country and part of making decisions for our community. And so that feeling of citizenship, I think, is really at stake. That people who have been in prison should get to be citizens again. And voting is a big part of that.
In the states where those regulations are tighter, what is the argument for that, typically?
A lot of these laws have existed for an awfully long time. The law in Alabama was basically a Jim Crow law, and the intention originally was to keep black people from voting. And the law was vaguely written so that local county registrars could disqualify any black person from voting based on some past arrest from a long time ago or kind of some criminal allegation. So it was really a law that originated in the system of racial segregation. Not all of the laws are that old, but a lot of them have been around for a long time and are based on this notion that, if you've committed a felony, you should no longer be a citizen of the country. You should not just be kind of quarantined from the rest of us through incarceration, but you should also have your rights stripped, whether that's voting or whether that's driving or the right to own a gun or professional licenses. All of that is stripped under these kinds of laws. So it's kind of a retribution for what you've done kind of idea.
What about situations, within that argument, you've also got people who were wrongly convicted. And I guess I'm just thinking about the idea of voting as representation. And it seems like that's a tool that someone might have to, to make their voice heard. You know what I'm saying?
No, definitely. I think what both LeBron and Stephen said about the importance of voting and how the issues at stake in an election can really affect incarcerated people is really true. There are local district attorney races, the election for your local prosecutor, that really affects how the criminal justice system works in a place like Kansas City. And being able to vote for that person is a really, really important tool in having a say in how the criminal justice system works, and all kinds of issues that affect formerly incarcerated people, from healthcare and Medicaid expansion to reentry programs to education. et cetera. So I think that there is this feeling among a lot of formerly incarcerated people that Lamont described of kind of like, what is this? What's the point of this? This isn't going to affect me. This is all kind of, this political system doesn't really have anything to do with me. They don't care about me. But there are really are issues at stake in these elections that affect formerly incarcerated people very directly.
When you look back on these past few years of so many states changing their regulations on this, what do you think is going on?
I think it's part of a larger criminal justice reform movement, beginning in the early, beginning around 2010, there was kind of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and then there was a series of police shootings that gained national attention thanks to, you know, cell phone videos. And there was also a number of states around the country implementing kind of criminal justice reforms to get people out of prison and into alternatives to incarceration. And there was kind of a consensus between Democrats and Republicans on this issue that putting so many people in prison was wasting money and also wasting lives. And so it's part of this larger rethinking of the mass incarceration that's developed in this country over the last few decades that I think has been going on and is still going on in a lot of states.
Lamont McIntyre, is that how you see it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one little thing that grows into a bigger problem. I just think it needs the importance of the voting thing, the importance of knowing that you have that right, the importance of knowing that your voice matters and your opinion matters, makes all the difference. And if people don't know that, you know, what can we do?
Lamont McIntyre, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Lamont served 23 years for a crime he didn't commit. Now he's free and voting. And Eli Hager with us from the Marshall Project, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next on Central Standard, what public transit can do to help with food insecurity. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and there's a new project that caught our attention, using the bus system to work on the problem of food insecurity. And if it seems like access to food has nothing to do with transit, tell that to someone with a bus ride that takes like an hour on a hot day, and then consider what that's like if you've got milk and eggs. Mamiko Voloman is with us from KC Healthy Kids to give us the story. Hi, Mamiko.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So this project is called Fair Food. That's fair spelled F-A-R-E, like bus fare.
That is correct. Yeah, we like our puns.
Well, one of the things you are doing right now is surveying people at bus stops about their routes to get groceries. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so like you said, it's called Fair Food Shopping. And one of the things that we've done for this project is to talk to the bus riders who are, you know, doing their grocery shopping by bus. In fact, you know, there, like you said, there are many neighborhoods in our Kansas City area where it's difficult to, you know, get a food. And many families living in those neighborhoods are more likely to, you know, be low income and have less likely to have a car in their households. So we're, you know, looking at food access issues, focusing on, you know, access to reliable transportation is one of you know, those barriers that are making it difficult for people to get fresh and healthy food. So we are serving people at the bus stops, and through our partners, we've distributed more than 300 surveys. And, you know, just to identify what are some of the challenges that they are facing, to identify opportunities where we can, you know, make the, make changes. And we've been working with Kansas City Area Transportation Authority on this project as well. They've been a great partner on this project to make it easier for people to do their grocery shopping by bus.
Well, tell me more about what you've been learning from these surveys.
Yeah, so like I said, we've received more than 300 surveys, and more than half of them don't have our car. So, and they're the regular bus riders, and more than 60 bus riders that we talked to receive, you know, SNAP benefits that's a food stamp benefits or other nutrition assistance programs. So that shows that, you know, these are the populations that are living in low income area. And also another thing that we found is that more than half of the bus riders that we talked to, it takes more than 30 minutes one way to get to their grocery store. So that's a that's not really surprising when you think about our transportation system in Kansas City. You know, some families have to take, you know, more than one bus, sometimes multiple buses, they have to make transfers to get to a grocery store. So some, you know, one of the individuals that we talked to, she said that it takes about 50 minutes to get to the grocery store that she regularly shops.
That doesn't surprise me, but what I think it's maybe helpful to think about, you know, it really is that how does on a hot day 50 minutes with a long transfer just sitting at a bus stop, how does that affect what you can buy at the grocery store too?
Yeah, that is a great point. And that's definitely something that we've heard from the people. In addition to the surveys, I should mention that we've also did a couple interviews where we tag along with the bus riders who regularly go shopping by bus. And they let us tag along and, you know, have a conversation on the way to grocery stores. And we also had some couple of focus groups on both sides. So, we've been having a conversation with them, like I said. And, yeah, it's definitely something that they've mentioned as one of the challenges.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation if transit issues have factored into your decisions about how to get food, what food you can get throughout Kansas City. 816-235-2888. You know, you've got a pilot program going on right now where you've got signage at some bus stops to help people map out the fastest routes to grocery stores. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so we've been working with KCATA, Diarrhea Transportation Authority, to create a signage that we piloted last, I think it was 2017. The signage has a little map that shows the fastest route that somebody can take to a nearest grocery store. So it shows which bus routes you can take, and also has a little infographic that shows how to ride a bus. Because some people who, you know, if you're not used to taking the bus on a regular basis, you know, you might not know how to ride a bus. And it's actually something that, you know, we heard in our conversations as well. And also has some, you know, some tips that will help make it a little bit easier for people to, you know, do grocery shopping by bus. Like, you know, you can make a list before you go shopping so you know exactly what you're getting and, you know, things like that.
But will the Transit Authority be looking at some of the information here and considering changing some of their routes?
Yeah, so KCATA and also the city having a great partner on the project, and they are active partner, and they and we will be, now that we are getting close to, you know, aggregating all the data that we collected through our assessments, we are just getting ready to share those results, and we'll be discussing in the next couple of weeks with KCATA to identify the next steps. And, you know, some of the solutions that we heard from the conversations that we have with bus riders, some of the, you know, we asked them, like, what do you think you would do if you were in charge of bus operations? And, you know, some of the things that they mentioned are long-term fixes. For example, you know, grocery shuttle, that a bus that will, you know, pick you up from your home to and take you to a grocery store with low cost. Something like that is a great idea. And I know some other cities in the country and in the Midwest have been doing it, have been piloting it. And so far, from what I see, it's been a great, you know, success. But something like that will definitely take a long time. So we will be working with KCATA to do a little fixes that will make it a little bit easier.
And then you've also been working on having recipes with ingredients that fit in a single grocery bag.
Yes, that is correct.
Because if you have a car, you don't maybe think about limits to how many grocery bags you can carry, but that would be a bigger deal on a bus ride.
Yeah, that is, it's also, that's something that we heard. And, you know, carrying the grocery shopping, you know, if you have to walk for, you know, for example, 20 minutes from a bus stop to your home, then you, you know, what you can carry is limited. What you can buy is definitely limited by what you can carry. And then also, you know, spaces on the bus is another issue that came up. So our hope is that those recipe ideas will help people get, you know, inspired and you know, using affordable, easy to carry ingredients that, the recipes will help, hopefully they'll help them.
Let's look at the other side of the state line. We've got Beau Hine with us from Nourish KC to talk about a different approach in Wyandotte County. And they've got something they're kicking off next month in October. Hi, Beau.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
You are focusing not on getting people to groceries, but on getting groceries to people with a mobile grocery store that takes WIC.
Correct. Yeah, it'll actually be the first mobile grocery store in the country to accept WIC as a payment option. So we are really excited to be able to pilot that here in the Kansas City metro.
It seems surprising that no one's done that before.
There are a lot of stipulations around WIC about the number of people that can shop at a site versus regular sales, how many places are in the area. One of the interesting things about Wyandotte County is that when you split the county kind of by the 635 corridor, you actually find that the county is split in half demographically. It's about 60,000 to 60,000, yet there's half as many WIC-approved grocery stores on the east side of the county. So our focus is really on that east side to see what we can do to bring those groceries to people, bring those healthy, fresh options that people want, and kind of overcome some of those issues around public transportation. You know, Kansas City is unique in the fact that we have a regional approach to transportation, but not a regional funding mechanism. So we rely on municipalities and counties to do the lift and do the heavy lifting across the region, which is really challenging. I think what we're finding in all of this research is that there isn't one silver bullet. There are a lot of opportunities. So
when you say all this research, can you share more about that?
I think there's, you know, the work that KC Healthy Kids is doing, DOT Agency and the KU School of Architecture, Healthy Communities Wyandotte, K-State Extension, WIC, SNAP. All of those places are doing a lot of research right now and have been for the last probably 2 to 3 years. Nourish KC got involved about a year and a half ago in this project. It had already been started with our partners at Humana and the Community Health Council of Wyandotte County. I think what we're finding right now is that there are a lot of solutions that can work depending on the area. We have a pilot in Leavenworth that we're hoping to debut in the spring that will actually be built grocery stores inside of churches or inside of healthcare settings, places where it's like a kiosk, like you would see in a mall. How can we get those groceries to people? You know, if you have children and trying to get to a grocery store, or if you have a disability or are aging and have mobility issues, that idea of even getting to a bus, nevertheless, riding a bus for 50 minutes is almost ridiculous.
You know, before we dive too deep back into the whole transit angle, can you give me a sense of what is maybe different about the context of Wyandotte County from what we just heard about Kansas City, Missouri?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if there are a ton of differences. I think we see pockets of the same thing happening everywhere. Even in Johnson County, we have many food deserts. One of the things that's interesting is that 21,000 Wyandotte County residents are what we consider food insecure. What's interesting is actually in Johnson County, it's over 60,000. And I think we often forget that hunger can happen anywhere. Food access happens everywhere. We also need to look at rural America. There are places that don't have a grocery store in miles, and you can't get there unless you have a car. I think many of us have been hoping for grocery delivery by drones, but I don't think that's going to be happening in a soon enough time. And it's not necessarily going to be affordable for people that are on low-income budgets.
So we do, when we talk about food deserts, we usually do talk about where the grocery stores are and not whether people have a way to get there. And that second piece of it seems really important, but can you talk about maybe it just seems like a growing awareness of that?
What's actually interesting is the definition of a food desert is not always universal. So a lot of people will think it's a mile from someone's home. Our research is indicating it's more of a half mile, so which would double the amount of food deserts we have in our region, which would be a very interesting proposition. It's that idea of where are people willing to go? Can they get there? Actually, can they buy enough to make it worth their while? If it's taking you 2.5 hours to go to the grocery store and you can only bring enough product home for a week, is that sustainable for somebody?
Well, also, I mean, a week seems, depending on how many people are in your house, pretty lofty if you're talking about a bag or two.
And then you add things like eggs and milk and produce, which people desperately want but don't have that access. I think what's interesting, you know, with SNAP being a little more flexible than a program like WIC, we can get some of those products in other places, and we have opportunities to get food in the broadest sense to people. You know, that bread, those Twinkies, and all of those fun things. It's that healthy food piece, that food is medicine, and that we have to be looking at the health of those in our community and how do we make sure that we lift everyone up.
So tell me more about how this whole mobile grocery store is going to work just from a practical standpoint.
So for the pilot, we're launching here in October. We have from research and from some data that we've collected from WIC, but also from Wyandotte County, we've identified 15 locations that we're currently vetting through an ordinance process in Wyandotte County. The mobile market will stop there every week at each of the 15 locations for up to 2 hours max. We'll work with the community in order to get people to know about the product. We'll be making sure we lean on our community ambassadors to get out there and spread the word and our partners.
2 hours max is something that seems maybe not so great because, I mean, obviously this food truck cannot be in, or grocery store, cannot be in every neighborhood all the time, but the likelihood that your schedule is going to allow you to grocery shop during that one, like, very short window of 2 hours within the week, that is pretty limiting. I mean, people have to work. People, that could be someone's kid's nap time when they are homebound. You know what I mean?
And that's part of what we're looking at in this experiment as well. I think, you know, mobile grocery stores are popping up around the country. We're not finding the silver bullet about a mobile grocery store yet. I think Oklahoma City's probably leading the way. St. Louis has an amazing project as well. We still haven't figured this out. And I think that's part of what we're looking at. Are there opportunities for us, because it's a limited product list, could we print the shopping list out and take it to people's homes and deliver door to door? We're looking at other opportunities to bring more infrastructure into our region about grocery access. Part of the design of the mobile market is to hit places where people gather naturally. So healthcare settings, schools, and kind of maximizing when the public is there. So it's not necessarily going down any random street. It does have to park in a commercial parking lot. It has to be a 100 feet away from a home. All of these rules are out there to protect everyone in this work. And there's a lot of misunderstanding of what a mobile grocery store can do. You know, we can't sell tobacco. We can't sell, you know, we're not going to sell unhealthy food. We've made that commitment. And the community council that is guiding this process is very committed to that work.
So what about this other recent announcement that the Merck is coming to KCK? It's such a popular health food co-op in Lawrence, but that is a very different setting than Wyandotte County.
Yeah, I think we're excited that something is coming. You know, the talk of the downtown campus is a healthy campus has been something going on for a long time. I think there are definitely concerns around, does that actually meet the need of the entire county? And do we need to do more? And what does that look like? You know, the struggle of finding someone willing to come into a small space is really the issue. It's a space capacity problem that we have throughout the region.
Well, our time is up. I do have so many more questions, but we'll just have to talk again. And especially as both of your programs really get off the ground and you have more information to share back on it. Bo Hines of Nourish KC, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mommy Co. Velleman with KC Healthy Kids, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
If you missed any of our conversation about food and transit on both sides of the state line, go to kcur.org/centralstandard and you can grab the whole thing later today. Earlier in the show, we talked about first-time voters this election cycle who are regaining their voting rights after being released from prison. It's all available at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Michelle T. about her career as a writer and activist. She also has several new books out, and she's coming to the Raven Bookstore later this month. So don't miss that conversation. It's part of our arts show tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.